From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the horror of Dracula and the horror of being typecast as Dracula, a talk with Christopher Lee, the British horror film star. Also today, we meet Deirdre Murray. She's one of the few women instrumentalists in jazz and one of the even fewer jazz cellists. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new recordings by Yugoslavian pianist Dubravka Tomsic. And book critic John Leonard reviews Joseph Wambaugh's new novel, The Golden Orange. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Rebel forces continue to advance in Liberia, and knowledgeable sources say President Samuel Doe may be ready to step down. George Guetta reports.
Doe is facing pressure to resign both from rebel forces and from close associates. U.S. officials say Doe's position is increasingly precarious. Most of his cabinet has resigned, and there have been numerous desertions from the security unit assigned to protect him. Virtually all public utilities in Monrovia have been shut down. An American Navy test force sits offshore, ready to evacuate the 795 Americans in Liberia should the need arise. U.S. officials believe Doe has a choice of resigning now or being forced out in a matter of days. He has ruled the country for 10 years. The rebels are led by Charles Taylor, a former government official who has received assistance from Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. Taylor has promised U.S. officials he will promote democracy and human rights if he assumes power. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
The perestroika reforms of Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev came under fire today at a Communist Party Congress session dominated by hardliners. Conservative Politburo member Yegor Ligachev won thunderous applause from the more than 4,500 delegates at the Congress when he denounced what he called a media campaign against hardliners and their allies in the military. Soviet Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze spoke for the reformers, charging that the country was ruined by massive military expenditures. Yegor Ligachev has been mentioned as a possible challenger to Gorbachev when the Congress elects its party leader. Ligachev has refused to say whether he'd be a candidate. Administration officials confirmed today that when President Bush goes to Europe for the NATO summit later this week, he'll take along a new proposal on when to use nuclear weapons. Alan Dowd with Maine Public Radio has more from Kenny Bunkport.
National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft told reporters that the president has written to other NATO leaders. Although Scowcroft would not provide details, he acknowledged that among the proposals Bush once considered at the summit is a new policy on using nuclear weapons only as a last resort. He said NATO must change its military strategy to deal with a changing Soviet threat.
No longer will there be, armies facing each other directly across a boundary. Instead, we're looking for the time when the Soviet Union will have withdrawn its troops behind Eastern Europe.
Scowcroft said NATO will remain important despite the changes in Europe. President Bush is scheduled to leave for the NATO meeting in London tomorrow. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Dowd in Kennebunkport.
Stock prices closed higher in light pre-holiday trading today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 12 points to close at 2,911.63. Advances edged declines. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 130 million shares. This is NPR. The Saudi Arabian government has announced that 1,426 Muslim pilgrims were killed in yesterday's stampede in a tunnel near the holy city of Mecca. A Saudi spokesman said the disaster was caused when seven pilgrims fell from an overhead bridge near the tunnel. Other sources said a power failure caused the air conditioning in the pedestrian tunnel to switch off in 112-degree heat, setting off a stampede in which the victims were suffocated or trampled. The disaster occurred during the Hajj, the annual religious pilgrimage to the shrines of Islam in Mecca. A Brooklyn man has been acquitted of second-degree murder for his role in last summer's killing of a black teenager in Bensonhurst. The jury was unable to reach a verdict on the second charge. Jim Zeroli has this report.
21-year-old John Vento was accused of being part of a gang that murdered black teenager Yusuf Hawkins last August after Hawkins wandered into their neighborhood to look at a used car. The jury spent 8 days deliberating Vento's fate. Finally, this morning, Judge Thaddeus Owens accepted a partial verdict after jurors said they were unable to reach agreement. Vento was found not guilty of one murder count, but he was convicted on some lesser charges, including unlawful imprisonment and discrimination. The jury was unable to agree on the second murder charge. Prosecutors have promised to retry Vento on that count. Another man was found guilty of murder for his role in the Hawkins killing, while a third was convicted on lesser charges. For National Public Radio, this is Jim Zaroli in New York.
The Romanian government said today that it plans to try 83 people for involvement in last month's political violence in Bucharest. The government also claims that 6 people who were killed in the violence died before coal miners were brought to the scene to back up the government. Government critics say the statements are part of a campaign to blame the violence on dissidents and restore Romania's international reputation. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Mr. Harker,
I'm glad that you've arrived safely.
Count Dracula.
I am Dracula, and I welcome you to my house.
For many horror movie fans, Christopher Lee created the definitive Dracula. Lee is perhaps the only actor who played Dracula, Frankenstein's monster, The Mummy, and Fu Manchu. Lee was the star of the horror films made by the British Hammer Film Studio in the 1950s and 60s. These movies were credited with reviving the horror genre and with helping to revive England's movie industry. The Curse of Frankenstein, The Horror of Dracula, Dracula Has Risen from the Grave, The Mummy, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, and The Wicker Man are just a few of the over 150 movies Christopher Lee has made. In America, he was the villain in the James Bond film, The Man with the Golden Gun. He was featured in 1941, and Serial. And now you can see him as Dr. Catheter in Gremlins 2. We invited Christopher Lee to speak with us from the NPR Bureau in London. I asked him if the director of Gremlins 2, Joe Dante, chose him for the film.
In 1978, I hosted Saturday Night Live in New York.
Oh, I remember that.
It's become quite a legendary show.
Yes.
And Steven Spielberg was in the audience, in the studio. And I think probably as a result of that, Steven asked me to appear in his film, 1941. He told me, and other directors of the same generation as Steven have also told me, which is immensely important to me as an actor, directors like Joe Dante, Martin Scorsese, Brian De Palma, John Landis, John Milius, and many, many more, told me that when they were very young and adolescent and growing up, it appears they were brought up almost exclusively, it would seem, on a diet of some of my films. And I didn't dare ask them which ones, but they seemed to have a great appreciation for the work that I'd been doing over the years, which is always, of course, a great joy for an actor to hear and to know. And I think, therefore, that the reason why Joe Dante asked me to play this part in this picture was because of his knowledge and, I believe, appreciation of certain films of mine over the years that he'd enjoyed.
I'm curious, in terms of the Dracula series of films that you did, did you have a special interest in that type of story, or was it more of circumstance that landed you in those movies?
I think probably both, because as a young man, indeed as a boy, I'd always been fascinated by fairy stories, which in a sense is what these stories are and what these films are too, of that particular type and of that particular period, the 50s and 60s. I was always fascinated by, as I said, fairy stories, fantasy, you know, demons, necromancers, gods and goddesses, everything that is out of our ken and out of our everyday world. I was always interested in enchantment and magicians, and still am. And also because I had read the book. Mm-hmm. And when by sheer chance in 1957 I did my first picture for Hammer, in which I didn't say a word, the only Frankenstein picture I ever did, I suppose in a sense it was a logical thing that they would offer me the next great classic Gothic character, perhaps the greatest of them all, because the picture that I did immediately after The Curse of Frankenstein was The Hound of the Baskervilles, in which I played the romantic lead. And I'm not sure if I did the first Dracula after that or whether I did another picture called The Mummy. I'm not too certain. The people who know would undoubtedly correct me if I'm wrong. But I suppose it was a kind of a logical progression in terms of the thinking of Hammer. Well, he's done this and he's done that. Well, why not give him a try at this one? Mm-hmm. And I had read the book, and I had perhaps discovered something in the character which other people hadn't or hadn't noticed or hadn't decided to present. And that is that the character is heroic, erotic, and romantic. I tried to put all those things over. And for your information, I gather that part has been played about 125 times in different languages all over the world. And I can tell you, on a personal level, and I know I'm right, that nobody has ever filmed in its entirety the book that Bram Stoker wrote.
Well, how much did you get into Bram Stoker's book and into other Dracula lore when you were making the Dracula movies?
Not much. Mm-hmm. I'd read the book as a boy and been terrified by it, of course. And I hadn't seen any of the films. I hadn't seen, for instance, the famous Black and White with Bela Lugosi. I'd seen many of his films, and I'd seen many of Boris Karloff's films, and indeed many of the films that they'd made together as a young man, and had been scared stiff by many of them. Little did I think that one day I would not only meet Boris, but would make three films with him, and that he would become a very close friend. I never met Lugosi, but when the opportunity came to play the character, I read the book again. And I think this helped me enormously. It may sound a bit of a cliche to say go to the book, but in fact, it's something that isn't always done.
Can you describe for us what your vision of Dracula was? How you saw the vampire and what characteristics you wanted to bring out?
I never thought of him as a vampire, ever. I mean, the blood is the life. That's one thing you have to bear in mind. And it is for all of us, isn't it? Here is a man who is immortal. Here is a man who, through being immortal, is a lost soul. Here is a man who experiences the loneliness of evil, something he can't control, who wants to die. But there is a force in him, a malefic force, which drives him to do these terrible things. I said earlier, the character is heroic, based on the real man, a war leader, and a national hero, I may say, in Romania to this day. Vlad the Impaler, certainly a bloodthirsty character, without a doubt. I also told you that the character is romantic, so he is, as far as women are concerned, and erotic, and there's, of course, the obvious association with the bite, in a sexual sense, if you like. So I tried to put all those particular characteristics into the character. It appears that I succeeded, even with some of the material, and even when I didn't say anything.
How were you first cast as Frankenstein's monster? How did you get that role?
Because I'm 6'4". I think is the answer to that. The first 10 years of my career, between 1947 and 1957, I was always being told, here in Britain, not in the States. That's why I rather wish I'd been born an American and had become an American actor, because my size, either too tall or too short, would have been immaterial. I was told over here I was much too tall for the average British leading man, and therefore out of the question that I would be in any kind of film with any of these people, because people's eyes inevitably gravitate to something that's either taller or shorter or fatter or thinner or whatever. And so, rather than being discouraged by this, which I thought was nonsense anyway, and indeed in a sense it is, I was all the more determined that during those 10 years before I got my first break, I would learn everything I possibly could about my craft, because it's a craft and a vocation as well as a job and a living. And I did. I did radio, I did television, I did opera, I did films, in which I had very, very little to say, but I had a lot of experience in front of the camera, and that's what really counts, so that when the time comes, okay, you're ready. I was also told I didn't look British enough because I'm partly Italian and they were making domestic movies and therefore I wouldn't fit in, you know, and all that kind of thing, which at times is absurd. at times, I suppose, you have to accept it. So, when they wanted a very tall man who had some experience of mime and didn't have to say anything, but could express emotions without speaking, they asked for me, or I think my agent suggested me, and they said, well, why not? And that's how it all started. And I thought, well, here I've been for 10 years trying to make something out of my life as an actor. I've learned a lot, but I haven't done much that's worthwhile. So maybe if I make people wonder what I really do look like and make myself unrecognizable, they will be interested and intrigued. And then maybe they'll say, well, let's have a look at him as he really does look, which eventually, of course, happened.
Well, why don't you describe what your face looked like in the Frankenstein film?
Oh, dreadful, like a road accident. You see, we weren't allowed to use the famous Karloff makeup because that was a copyright with Universal Films. And so we just had to go through a series of tests deciding, really, on, what would be right and what would be wrong. Some of the makeups were quite unacceptable and some were even faintly comic. But I think the answer is this: when you're playing a character which is put together from bits and pieces of other bodies, you've got to make it look that way.
Right. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is actor Christopher Lee, and he's co-starring in the new film Gremlins 2. He's made over 150 movies in his career and starred in several now classic horror films made in England by the Hammer Studios, including The Curse of Frankenstein and The Horror of Dracula. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Christopher Lee is my guest, and you can now see him as Dr. Catheter in the movie Gremlins 2. He's joining us from NPR's London Bureau. The two movies that we've been talking about, your Frankenstein film and the first Dracula film that you were in, were really the movies that revived the horror genre, and they were the movies that the Hammer Studio made their reputation on in England. Do you know why they decided to embark on these horror films?
I don't, actually, and the only person who could probably tell you, or there might be two or three, but the only person who would definitely be able to tell you, James Carreras, Sir James Carreras, who was the head of Hammer, passed away about 2 weeks ago, which was a great loss to the industry in general and to us in particular. Although he'd retired, we need a great many people like Jimmy Carreras in the British film industry today, because we need entrepreneurs and promoters and people who can sell ideas and films. And the great thing about Hammer, which is unique in the history of British films, is that they were not only the most successful independent production company ever in the history of the British cinema, but they had an automatic built-in guarantee of distribution with every single American major, and that has never happened before or since. He obviously had the idea with Tony Hines, and that was it. There were basically, I suppose, two people responsible. And, of course, when the first picture took off, followed by the second, the third, and the fourth, Hammer became a known name throughout the entire world. It still is. People still talk to me about Hammer Films and Hammer Productions. The company still exists and is, I believe, talking about going back into possible television and motion picture production, but it's not the company that existed when I worked for them.
It took 7 years before you made, 6 or 7 years before you made the first sequel to Horror of Dracula. Why did it take so long? Did you not want to do another one, or did they not initiate it?
I've no idea. I never really knew, because the first one was either 57 or 58. You know, it's so long ago, I've forgotten almost everything about it. You're talking about 33 years ago. And the second one was in 1965, I think it was. I did it back-to-back with another picture, which was a much better film, in which I played Rasputin, and of course much more interesting to me as an actor, playing somebody who really existed. I don't know why there was this gap. I've no idea. I never thought of asking anybody, really. I think the problem was that in subsequent years, and I made this claim, and I'm on record as saying it, I made it very plain, the qualities of the stories with that particular character went downhill, and they deteriorated. And instead of writing a story around the central character, they wrote the story first and then tried to find a way of fitting the character in, and that never works no matter what the character is. And I became progressively disenchanted, and I said, look, you know, you've got a great character here and you're not making the best out of it, which is why I stopped in 1971.
Wasn't there one film where you thought that the lines were so bad that you refused to read any of the dialogue?
There was a second one.
That was the second one?
Yes, The Prince of Darkness. I read the script and I said, I won't say anything in this picture. I cannot possibly say these lines. They're not only unsayable, but they'll have everybody rolling about for the wrong reasons. This is the difficulty, of course, about making a film of this kind. You're treading such a very, very narrow line between credibility and absurdity. If you slip on the wrong side, you've lost the audience and the picture's dead. Fortunately, it seems that over the years we were able to maintain that credibility, and the audience, in the famous phrase, suspended its disbelief for an hour and a half to 2 hours and accepted what we showed them. But they're very difficult to play, these characters, obviously, because they're so outlandish and they don't exist yet. And consequently, when I read this dialogue and read this script, I said to them, oh, come on, you know, I'm not going to say any of these lines. Can you imagine somebody in front of a camera actually saying, I am the apocalypse? Now, unless you're making a religious picture or a picture like The Exorcist, this would sound ridiculous.
Well, was there a friction on the set between the people who had a more campy approach to the movies and the people who were really more serious about it, and the people who were hacks and the people who really had a vision?
I don't think anybody had a campy approach. I think we all took our work seriously when we came actually to shoot it. That doesn't mean to say that we didn't have a lot of laughs during the rehearsals and sometimes indeed during the shots when something went wrong. Of course, we all knew each other very, very well, both the performers and the technicians, which really was, in the famous cliché, one big happy family. And there's never been a period like that in the history of the British cinema, and never really one like that in my life as an actor. We all liked each other, we all respected each other and knew each other. We were all experienced professionals on both sides of the camera. And if anybody camped it up, I can assure you it wasn't deliberate. And I would have thought that in most cases, the director would have had something to say about that. Obviously, we did have a lot of laughs. I frequently plunged past the camera with my contact lenses in because I was almost blind and couldn't see the person I was supposed to grab or assault or whatever it was. And there was an occasion when I had to pick a girl up off the ground and charge across this open space and throw her into a grave. And in one take, I succeeded in doing that. It's rather difficult picking somebody straight up off the ground, rather like being a weightlifter. And I tottered on the edge of this grave and fell straight in on top of her. So, of course, one had a lot of very amusing incidents. But if anybody regards those pictures as camp, I think they're doing a disservice to the very experienced professional people involved.
Oh, I mean, I agree. You were killed in many different ways in those movies. Did you have any stunts that you had to do yourself for any of the death scenes?
Oh, I did everything myself in those days. I'm an honorary member of three stunt men's unions.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. And there's a book called Stunt in which I have four or five pages to myself. May not be generally known, but I have done more sword fights in front of a camera than probably anybody in history, if you include TV and motion pictures. And I've got the scars to prove it, too. All given me by fellow actors, never by stuntmen.
How much of a problem did you have with typecasting after the horror films that you made in the 50s and 60s?
Was I typecast? Yes, I was over a period of time. There are always two sides to every coin. And just as success, in one respect, is something that every actor or actress is hoping for, and for the right reasons, not to collect money, which seems to be the case these days, but to achieve as much as you can in your chosen profession. Just as success is important, so that your face and your name should be known and the two should go together all over the world, not just in one country, in a domestic market. Just as that is so important, so there is the other side to success, that because you become successful playing one character or in one kind of film or wearing, if you like, a raincoat, I need go no further on that particular matter, it can be a disadvantage because people suddenly get the impression that that's all you do and all you can do. So I was certainly typecast, certainly playing heavies in general, and sometimes horror films in particular, although it may surprise you to know that by my own personal count, I've only appeared in 15 pictures I would describe as horror movies. A lot of people are going to argue with that one, but that's my personal opinion, which is obviously the opinion of an actor about his own work. Now, this was becoming quite a problem for me. Typecasting always is, as everybody knows. And everybody is typecast up to a point or has been in his or her career. I remember Boris Karloff saying to me, find something that nobody else can do or will do, even if it is a type of role, and you'll be the only one. And there's nothing wrong with that. Indeed, there isn't. But if you want to be a real actor and a true professional, and you want to show whatever versatility you think that you possess, you want to have the chance to show it. I would never have got that chance if I had remained here in Britain, because casting was, and still is to a certain extent, cautious, conservative, and bound by tradition. He only has made this kind of film. He made in it. This is all he does or she does or whatever. This applies also to directors and writers. And it's a big problem. So I was determined I was going to break this, these shackles, if you like to call them that. And I was told by many of my friends who are senior executives in the film industry in LA, and by many of my friends who are producers and directors and actors and actresses, I was told by them that if I stayed here in Britain, I would make a good living, and I would go on doing the same sort of film and playing roughly, very roughly, the same sort of role, the heavy, the sinister killer or whatever, the hard man, whatever you like to call it. And I eventually would become frustrated and disenchanted and perhaps bored. Inevitably, of course, the audience would too. They said, you've got to come to the States. There, you will have the opportunity of showing what you can do, other parts that you can play. There will be many, many more films made, many, many more parts available to you. And it proved to be true.
You've made films in many different countries, and you once said that every country has a different image of who you are as an actor and what kind of roles you play best.
The people, yes.
Yeah. Can you give us a sense of how you're regarded in different countries you've worked in?
Well, obviously, in the more primitive countries, I'm not going to name them, where people have more primitive beliefs, in any kind of gothic type of picture, they are very close to believing what they see. And sometimes they are actually afraid of approaching me. Or where. I don't think that's the case anymore. I've had people making the sign of the evil eye against me in Spain, for instance, in remote villages and places like that, and taking their children off the streets as I walked down the road. That was a long, long time ago. I was actually making a Western at the time with Raquel Welch called Hanny Calder, and that was 1970, so that's 20 years ago. It depends where you are. Some people appreciate what I do when I play one particular kind of character. Others appreciate it more when I play comedy. Others appreciate it more when I play tragedy. Others prefer the horror genre kind of film. Others prefer something else. But mostly, and this is, after all, the most important thing of all, people say to me, we like your pictures. We like your work. They're not specifying any one picture or any one part necessarily. And that, after all, is more important than anything else.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Not at all. It's a pleasure.
My guest has been actor Christopher Lee, and you can now see him as Dr. Catheter in the film Gremlins 2. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we talk with the creator of the original Batman comic, Bob Kane. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Deirdre Murray plays cello with some of today's most adventurous jazz composers, like Henry Threadgill, Mujal Richard Abrams, and David Murray. Coming up, Deirdre Murray deals with stereotypes of cellos and women in jazz. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews new albums by the Yugoslavian pianist Dubravka Tomsic. And novelist Joseph Wambau is back with his first new cop novel in 5 years. Book critic John Leonard has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Having already achieved monetary union, there is a report that East and West Germany have agreed to hold elections for a single German parliament on December 2nd. Sources in Bonn say that West German Chancellor Kohl favors a December election date. Deidre Berger reports.
With the economic merger of the two Germanys this week, pressure is building to complete the political unification before the end of the year. Last night, the governing coalition in East Germany said it favors all German elections on December 2nd. That is the date originally intended for West German parliamentary elections. But the East German government warned elections will only be possible if the 2+4 talks solve the security problems surrounding unity. West German Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher says he also favors all German elections in December. Both East and West German politicians this week say the transition period to unification should be kept as short as possible. The two governments are expected to start negotiations later this week for a treaty regulating political unification. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in West Berlin.
A private group says that the NATO alliance is no longer needed to keep the peace in Europe and should be replaced by a coalition of all nations in Europe, plus the U.S., the Soviet Union, and Canada. The plan by the British American Security Information Council would do away with NATO and the Warsaw Pact. In Saudi Arabia, over 1,400 Muslim pilgrims died in Monday's accident inside a crowded tunnel leading to the holy site of Mecca. The tragedy came at the end of a pilgrimage which has been marred by terrorism in recent years. Mike Theodulo has more from Nicosia.
This was the worst ever tragedy to strike the Hajj, and it came despite huge expenditure by the Saudi Arabian authorities to cope with the ever-increasing numbers. Prince Nayef said that seven pilgrims fell from an overcrowded pedestrian bridge leading to the tunnel entrance, where people were pushing to get inside. Pilgrims packed inside, panicked, and tried to retreat. There were 50,000 jammed inside the tunnel, far more than it was designed to take. Hundreds were trampled to death or suffocated in a stampede. Earlier accounts blamed the disaster on a ventilation failure inside the tunnel, but Prince Nayef made no mention of this. Expressing his condolences, King Fahd said the accident was God's will. Had they not died there, he said, they would have died elsewhere and at the same predestined moment. King Fahd said the authorities could not be blamed. They had done everything to ensure the safety and comfort of the pilgrims. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 12 points to close at 2,911.66 on volume of 130 million shares. Trading was light as advances edged out declines. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Pianist Dubravka Tomsic is a star in her native Yugoslavia, and she's getting better known in this country. On July 9th, she'll open the Newport Music Festival for the second time in a row. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews her two latest albums on the Stradivari label.
You can never tell how much a recording engineer has improved a performance. How many times have you gone to a concert and come away disappointed because the performer's sound was smaller, the technique less reliable than you heard on a recording? With pianist Dubravka Tomsic, just the reverse happened. Her albums of Scarlatti, Chopin, Bach, and Beethoven revealed an artist of deep seriousness effortless technique and wide stylistic sympathies. But she's even more impressive in person. Her own style is direct and unpretentious. You like her even before she starts to play. For all her extraordinary range of tone, color, and dynamics, her performances are never self-serving, but always at the service of the music. Last summer, she opened the Newport Festival with a program of composers familiar from her recordings, and one surprise, Debussy. Now, the Debussy album she recorded just after that concert has finally been released, and it's both a wonderful souvenir of that event and a new confirmation of her powers. With Debussy, the music has to flow, but how easy it is for overly fluid fingers to dissolve Debussy's rhythmic complexity into a hazy mist. Then listen to the rhythmic bite Tomsic gives Soirée dans Grenade, Debussy's sensuous, urgent essay on Spanish rhythms. Debussy was a lot more than a colorist. Tomsic pays as much attention to Debussy's daring new harmonies and rhythmic structures as to his delicate atmospherics. She finds the backbone, the elemental underlying structure, like the simple geometrical form behind all the impressionist brushstrokes in a great Monet. Debussy also has a sense of humor. Imagine homage à S. Pickwick Esquire, PPMPC, played by someone without one. Last year, Terry Gross asked Tomsic if it was harder to play profound slow music than breathtaking displays of speed. Tomsic agreed that it was, but then cautioned that fast music must also be played with thought and expression. That's what makes her performances of pieces like L'Île Joyeuse and Feu d'Artifice so exciting. Listen to some of the fireworks. The Stradivari label has also issued a Tomsic album called Favorite Encores. What a treat it is to hear such a variety of old chestnuts taken seriously. Debussy's Clair de Lune, Rachmaninoff's Prelude in C-sharp minor, Schumann's Traumerei, Chopin's most famous Polonaise, and Beethoven's Für Elise, as well as pieces by Brahms, Liszt, Tchaikovsky, Grieg, and Sinding, the familiar rustle of spring. Here's the beginning of the tender Für Elise. If you're wondering what happened to the first three notes, so am I. They're not on my copy. This album of encores is designed to display range, but even here, Tomsich doesn't have to show off. She can leave that to the composers.
Lord Schwartz is classical music critic for the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. Deirdre Murray is one of the very few cellists in jazz, and she plays with some of today's most adventurous jazz composers, like Henry Threadgill, David Murray, and Muhal Richard Abrams. She also composes, produces, and leads several ensembles with bassist Fred Hopkins. Murray plays on Muhal Richard Abrams' new album, Haringa Suite.
Cello part is segments of other people's music, and what I'm actually doing is chorusing what other musicians are doing, so that it takes what they do takes on a different quality. It's very interesting what he did. There, a lot of the music didn't have a contrapuntal line or a different line. It was just something that saxophonist did, or this person did, or that person did. And I doing it in unison with them, but when you put the two together, it sounds a different way.
Mm-hmm. Abrams also wrote a cadenza for you, or you're improvising it. I'm not sure which.
Improvised.
Okay. So that's totally improvised,
sure.
The cadenza?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what you did with it?
I really can't, because I haven't heard it. That's about a year ago. I've seen a few people in the street, and they say, that's a really... I've been hanging out with Fred Hopkins, and they say, Fred, that's a really great bass solo you played. And I said, is there a bass solo? And he said, Deirdre, that's what you did. So that's all I can answer. What I was trying to do was something very different than what the other people did. What I do musically is based on sound rather than running patterns, although, of course, I run patterns. And what I was trying to do is get as far away from what anybody else did as I could, and I think the nature of the instrument would allow me to do that.
Do you think there are so few cellists in jazz? Is it something inherently involved with the instrument? Is the instrument particularly hard to play in a jazz setting? Or is that another reason?
I just think that basically, that's a very big question. I think it's class issues. I think that in general, the more middle class you are, the more you tend to have start playing those instruments, especially for black people earlier. If you're in, talented in music, and you're a kid, and you're a black kid, what's likely to happen is you're going to play piano, or maybe even clarinet in a marching band, or something else. You're not likely to play something where you're going to play in a string quartet, because it might socially not come up.
Mm-hmm. So how did you get to play cello?
I wanted to be a violinist, and I was watching those, I can't remember the movie, but it's an old Betty Davis movie, My mother used to work in the post office at night, and I said, Ma, I have to do this thing. I got to play this violin. And my mother was a dancer, so what she said to me was, you can play something that looks like that, but nothing squeaking high. So instead of me playing the violin, she says, oh, cello, that's nice and low. That won't keep me awake in the daytime while she was sleeping. So when I, you know, it's a public, New York public school system, I was probably 10, and instead of asking for a violin, which is what I really wanted, they gave me a cello.
And you took to it right away?
Yeah, immediately.
You played in a couple of symphonies, right?
Yeah, a long time ago.
How long? How old were you?
19, 20, someplace in there.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard as a black cellist to get a chair in the symphonies?
No, what really, my problem in the symphony was that it wasn't my kind of... a groove. I mean, I hated wearing black dresses.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was that basic. I was always nervous. It wasn't the music. It was the... I was always used to being free spirit, and I could not stand to be restrained. I could not stand bear to play a melody the same way twice. So, therefore, I never fit. And also, I used to have great stage fright. Anything that, you know, I could play everything at home, and as soon as I got in front of people in terms of classical music, I would totally freeze up. I mean, great. It was like almost phobic. I had a great phobia. But that was because it was against my nature to repeat anything.
So when you started playing jazz, did the phobia go away?
Well, yes, I never repeat. I mean, that's the idea. It's the reason I love jazz beyond, you know, obvious reasons that it's totally expressive to the individual self. I mean, you never have to do anything the same way twice. Although, if I want to, I can.
When you started playing jazz, was it hard to get bands that would accept you because you were a cellist and not a bassist?
No, because I always had my own band.
Oh, always. That's one way of getting around it.
Well, yeah, well, I didn't know what I was doing was weird until I was like 22 or 23 years old. I really didn't know because I was always insulated. You know, I played with my cousin, I had a girl cousin, we had our own bands, and we made records, and we ran around the country. I didn't know, you know, it's you're talking about the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know that what I was doing was unique until I was about 23, 24. And then by the time I was 30, I found out that was really unique.
Did being a woman ever stand in your way at all?
I think that it stood most in my way. Because the lifestyle, especially, even now, but 10, 15 years ago, is not... what's the word? Amenable to the way I was raised. Basically, you know, I'm very, what's the word? Studious. And basically, all I do is play the music and then I leave. So, therefore, hanging out, carousing, and all that stuff was never my bag. So, I think that the way I was raised didn't go with how it is. So, and also, that's why I'm saying that by the time I became 30, I realized what I was doing was uniquely weird. Because then it was... How many bands? You know, by the time you're 30, if you've been playing long enough, people have to take you seriously, but then they don't want to because there is really no serious cello tradition in jazz and that men were having, you know, serious problems with it.
How do those problems get expressed to you?
You can't play. Something that basic. I know you can't play the blues. What are you doing here? Or I'll be in a band, everybody in the band gets reviewed except for me. Or you get a review, people say that, oh, she must be somebody's girlfriend. Or they, if you are running a band or you're running a session, I was running a session as a producer for somebody's record that I won't talk about. And when all the musicians, I had hired all the musicians, but they thought I was a secretary. And when all the musicians came in, they kept looking for the producer and they shook everybody's hand. And they kept looking. I watched them look. I said, well, here I am, guys, you know. So that's how it's expressed.
Since there is no cello tradition in jazz, when you started playing jazz a lot, did you miss having anyone to base your sound on or to base your part on?
Well, I based my sound off of basically bassists and saxophonists like Eric Dolphy.
Mm-hmm.
And because there is no cello tradition, nobody told me that was weird either. You have to realize, in other words, whatever came in my mind, my imagination to do, I just did it. Because no one could tell me it was wrong to do because I didn't have a teacher. I had a cello teacher, but I didn't have a teacher in jazz. So I learned just from experience. If I heard something that Eric Dolphy did, I would take it and try to do it. It would come out differently on cello, but the concept, the ideology from which it sprung, is what I would do.
On Henry Threadgill's records, you play cello and Fred Hopkins plays bass.
Mm-hmm.
And you and Fred Hopkins have been working together in your own band now. So I guess you've really been liking working together and the sound
mm-hmm.
that you get together?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Have you been learning a lot about the differences between cello and bass by playing together?
No, because I already knew it. I always knew. It's
okay.
What the thing I like about Fred is that he is so confident that as a bass player, he doesn't feel that I'm trying to take away his function. A lot of bass players used to feel that I was, stepping on their toes, but actually I was fulfilling this other function. But Fred, has no problem with that. We'll do a phrase, and he'll play the first half, and I'll play the second half, naturally, without any music. Because we actually hear it that way.
So do some people still think that a cello can't swing, so to speak?
Sure. I think a lot of people still think that.
Yeah.
They might think that I can swing, but cello cannot.
And you want to prove otherwise?
Yeah, I just want to put that to rest forever. Amen. And I want to do something that's recorded that puts that to rest so no one ever talks about that ever again.
Well, Deirdre Murray, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Cellist Deirdre Murray. Here's Murray playing a walking cello line with Fred Hopkins on bass from Henry Threadgill's latest album, Rag, Bush, and All. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We're going to be hearing from reporter Wendy Schmelzer again, second part of her series on wife abuse. And today, in the concluding story, Wendy looks at what court orders separating an abusive husband from his wife, what effectiveness they actually have in preventing wife abuse. Also, news from the Communist Party Congress in Moscow, and a visit to a town in Soviet Georgia where just about everyone you meet is a dyed-in-the-wool Stalinist. It's actually late Soviet dictator's hometown.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Joseph Wambau is an ex-cop who writes best-selling police thrillers like The New Centurions, The Onion Field, and The Blue Knight. He's just come out with his first novel in 5 years. The Golden Orange is about an ex-cop in Southern California. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Over the years, I've been up and down on Joseph Wambau's cop novels. The Choir Boys seemed to me just about perfect, with its battered children and its severed heads. The Black Marble was too cute, with everybody running around the Los Angeles Memorial Sports Arena at a big-time dog show, and a cop who dreamed of wounded rabbits and nightingales singing in the raspberry bushes of old Mother Russia. The Glitter Dome was a recovery of form, about Hollywood and evil, about a roller rink in a parking lot behind a bowling alley, where mad skaters with Sony Walkmans waltzed themselves to death, and a beach where old people went to sell their gold and wound up with their mouths taped and their throats slit. Any Wambau novel, though, is better than none, and it's been 5 years since his last one. I know his true crime stuff is made for television miniseries, but I miss Chinatown and Caltech and The Big Sewer, the tides of violence and the savage jokes and the cops who ate their guns. It's as if he wrote The Golden Orange just for me, Once more, Wambau's The Angry Anthropologist in a Southern California zone of dread. Golden Orange refers to Orange County, the capital of white-collar crime in the American Southwest, where everybody's rich and right-wing Republican, except the houseboys, where the airport's named for John Wayne, an entire county of parvenu banks and landlocked yachts and Rolls-Royce dealerships and hot mamas looking for their third millionaire, jetting at the country club from patio to hole-in-one, leaving vapor trails of wrinkle cream behind them. We'll also visit Newport Beach, a town with more masseuses than the Ottoman Empire, and Catalina Island, where buffalo roam under Art Deco murals. And, of course, Spoon's Landing, a seedy bar like all the seedy bars in all of Wambau's novels, where off-duty cops end up drinking so they won't shoot themselves to death. At Spoon's Landing, where everybody's always remarking like a Greek chorus on the world's madness, a male turtle is trying to make it with a female turtle in a puddle of spilled beer. This is symbolic. Winnie Farlow, an ex-cop and part-time ferry boat pilot, is also trying to make it, with Tess Binder, a hot mama between prenuptial agreements, whose dead father's homosexual lover may or may not be scamming her real estate inheritance. About Tess, Winnie is advised, "I tell you, stay away from those broads. None of them ever had an orgasm unless it happened on Shop Till You Drop Day at South Coast Plaza. If local paramedics have to learn life-saving liposuction, it's because of them." Winnie, of course, doesn't listen. This is because he's a straight-ahead guy, an innocent, and also because he's a drunk. As much as it's about Orange County, money, and boats, The Golden Orange is also about alcoholism. And the whole novel is just as symbolic as those turtles. I don't want to frighten anybody out of reading a terrific book just because it has a deeper meaning. But all this love and death occurs in Easter week, during a hot Santa Ana wind. When Winnie goes into the desert to get shot at, he trespasses on the mythic. There will also be a parting of the waters, and a fisher of men, and ready or not, a resurrection. Maybe even two of them.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine. He's a columnist for New York Newsday and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Golden Orange by Joseph Wambau. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Joan Tuohy and Roberta Sherrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Bob Kane, the artist who created Batman. And we meet the man who has everything, including the wrong haircut, rocker Ben Vaughn. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Good evening. It's just 8 o'clock here at 91 FM. I'm Peter Bryant, sitting in tonight for Melinda Whiting on Evening Classics, and I hope you'll stay tuned. Lots of good music for you, including the Idyll for String Orchestra by Leo Janáček, some Rachmaninoff preludes, also songs by Beethoven, and some chamber music by him as well. That and much more to look forward to between now and 11.